Hello, and welcome to a special bonus episode of the Radical Thoughts podcast. This episode is a companion to our piece on Norberto Bobbio's Liberalism and Democracy. In this episode, I interview David Broder. Broder is a historian. He is also the European editor for Jacobin magazine. Right now, you're listening to 22 Ghosts 3 by Nine Inch Nails, but in a second, you'll hear Broder and I discuss the political situation of post-war Italy, interpretations of Antonio Gramsci's prison notebooks, and the effect of the historic compromise between the PCI and the Christian Democratic Party in Italy. David Broder is a Rome-based writer and translator. He works as a contributing European editor for Jacobin magazine, and he specializes on European politics, especially Italy and France. And he has an upcoming book called First They Took Rome, coming out through Verso Books, and it should actually be available tomorrow as of today's recording. So, David, thank you so much for agreeing to come on.
Oh, thanks for inviting me.
So I invited you to come on and talk a little bit about the Italian kind of post-war political scene, because our last kind of book club read that we did on the podcast was Norberto Bobbio's Liberalism and Democracy, and we were all really interested in what he was trying to talk about. And he's got a couple books in English. There's been some interaction with him in, say, New Left Review, and he's clearly represented in all the English literature as having been a very important figure in post-war Italian politics, but that whole scene is kind of, it's very complicated. I'm not a scholar on it at all, but I've read, some more popular books. I've read, Storming Heaven, that kind of thing. And it's, in general, I feel like the U.S., in the U.S. at least, there isn't a whole lot of focus on Italy, even, through World War II as much, partially because of our focus on Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan. And so that whole scene is kind of underrepresented in our kind of historical, collective intellect or something like that. How would you kind of define the importance of what was going on? I mean, obviously this is a huge question. It's what was going on in politics after the biggest conflict ever? After Italy is kind of the World War II period is starting to come to an end. They have, the resistance, the Italian Social Republic is there and it's getting defeated. And my understanding is that the major political parties coming out of this are the Christian Democrat Party, the Socialist Party or the PSI, and the Communist Party or the PCI. And that there's also a bunch of kind of weird U.S. involvement and how this new republic is getting set up. So how could you speak a bit to kind of what the major players are in terms of what's going on after World War II and how that's setting up kind of the context of politics in Italy at this time?
Yeah, so I think the important moment really is the transition from the resistance, in which there's the unity of the main anti-fascist parties, and then the beginning of the Cold War. Italy during World War II, and more specifically from 1943 to 1945, is gradually taken over by the British and American occupier / liberators. And at the same time, you have the growth of this national resistance movement against the German occupation, which includes the parties you mentioned, the Christian Democrats, the Communists, the Socialists. And in fact, it also includes a party called the Action Party, which is important to our theme in that Norberto Bobbio was a member, but also it was actually the second biggest armed force in the resistance, the biggest one being the Communist Party. So while the resistance doesn't play an entirely decisive military role in ending the German occupation and overthrowing Mussolini, of course, the main driving force is the Western Allies. Nonetheless, the fact of the mass mobilization, let's say tens or low hundreds of thousands of people in the armed struggle, plus the massive strike waves and land occupations and other sort of social movements of the resistance period, powerfully assert the workers' parties and the left as a force in national political life in a way that they hadn't been in, of course, during the fascist period, but or even beforehand. So the politics of post-war Italy are basically split between the parties that had been in the resistance struggle together, but which sort of crack apart or head in different directions thanks to the onset of the Cold War internationally. This is partly driven by disputes over, for instance, the Marshall Plan. Basically American aid, which is partly premised on the sort of support for the Western side in the Cold War, and then Italy joining NATO in 1949. So while at the immediate end of World War II, there's a joint government of Christian Democrats, Communists, Socialists, the Action Party, some other smaller liberal forces. In spring 1947, this alliance cracks apart. And then from 1947, for the rest of the next 45 years, so up until the early 1990s, the Christian Democrats are the dominant party in national government. In fact, they are constantly in national government. So they have smaller allies at times. In the 60s, the Socialists come into a coalition for the first time with the Christian Democrats. But the Communists are never properly in national government, even as a coalition partner. So a lot of the history of Italy during the Cold War period is precisely about this kind of structural situation where there's no exchange of power between the main two parties, the Christian Democrats, who are in national government, and then the Communists, who are the largest party by membership, but kind of never quite get there in terms of votes. So, in the first post-war elections, the Communists are around 20%, and by the mid-70s, at their peak, they reach a third of the electorate, 34% in the 1976 elections. And they're, a massive kind of cultural presence, civil society force. They have cooperatives, they run the trade unions, they're very powerful. And, you asked earlier, why is Italy an interesting country? It's because it's the biggest communist party in the West, and it's one that prides itself on a certain sort of democratic tradition. Certainly in the 1970s, sort of asserts itself as not being just a Stalinist party, but one which boasts of its own role, both as an anti-fascist party, but also as a party which is internally starting to become a bit more plural or at least sort of open culturally. And that's why, of course, also because of the way the party draws on the legacy of it, Antonio Gramsci, who died in 1937 and was both kind of a martyr, but also sort of intellectual inspiration. The history of the Italian Communist Party is interesting for thinking about questions of, like how could a Communist Party succeed in a Western country with parliamentary democracy.
Yeah, I certainly, from my position, it's almost impossible to imagine like a mass popular communist party having like that kind of level of involvement in a contemporary situation, and that has been something that's very always fascinating. So in the few times I've like read about it, just that level of involvement. And I guess there's a couple things One thing is, of course, connecting back to Norberto Bobbio, you mentioned the Action Party, and which was involved in the resistance. And that's kind of, in our discussion, we mentioned how he's kind of considered what is sometimes called a liberal socialist. And he kind of saw himself, my understanding is, as someone who was trying to kind of mediate these between these different socialist groups. And he was very invested in the idea of maintaining the kind of liberal Republican tradition and a certain kind of, you know, state sphere, and while maintaining personal private rights and that kind of thing. Can you speak a little bit more to how, if you know a little bit more about how liberal socialism as a, I don't like using this term too over generally, but kind of as a ideological force saw itself, and how, because I think, you know, in the U.S., to talk about liberal socialism, if you're someone who's kind of more properly a leftist, it might sound just like, you know, kind of like Bernie Sanders or something like that. You might just think of kind of democratic socialism in the contemporary sense. Or you might think it might speak more broadly to kind of like, you know, general terms for left populism or something like that. And I mean, I certainly don't know what would distinguish them, or if there were big distinguishing factors or something that really defined how they separated themselves from, say, even if they were definitely separate from the Communist Party, Marxist Communist Party, I don't know how they saw themselves as distinguished from, say, the PSI, or other kind of democratic socialist parties. So could you speak, do you know a little bit more about what, how the Action Party saw themselves in this kind of situation?
Yeah, so I mean, two things I'd say to start off with is, firstly, that the meaning of liberalism in Italian political history is particularly, I think Perry Anderson mentions it in the essay, The Affinities of Norberto Bobbio, that liberalism is kind of all things to all people in Italian history, and it is also kind of strangely absent, in the sense that if we think of the sort of centrist common sense in Italy now, it's always kind of like, oh, if only we had a developed liberal tradition, it's never really existed. And at the same time, if you look at the history of Italy after national unification in the 1860s up to World War One, you have a certain kind of liberal hegemony, but in different, very different forms. So on the one hand, it can be this kind of providential sort of liberty, sort of history is the progress of liberty, the sort of heroic bourgeoisie, or perhaps also kind of drawing on things like Giuseppe Mazzini and his role in the struggle for national independence and unification. And yet liberalism is also the bourgeois politicking of like Giovanni Giolitti in the period of World War One. He was Italy's leading statesman at that time. And it's like a byword for an extremely elite and undemocratic form of parliamentary politics and horse trading. Of course, the liberalism of this period isn't like, you know, mass parties or mass politics, but talking about sort of parliamentary factions. Then the other thing I'd say is that, as a sort of very general historical premise, is that in Italy, there's a very strong tradition from the late 19th century of kind of a kind of non-Marxist socialism, but which is an idea of kind of like like a kind of idea of like the rational and the rational state, which will raise up the society from its backwardness. And so you have a certain kind of prevalence in sort of university milieus of something akin to the German Cathedra Sozialisten, they're sort of like reformers and programmers and so on, who have nothing to do with like Marxism or the workers' movement, but who would call themselves socialist in the sense of wanting a resolution of the social problem, a harmonious society. This is also why a lot of the early socialist literature in Italy are actually kind of stuff like works of like criminology. It's like, yeah, social problems. So the specific idea of mixing liberalism and socialism has several different sort of sources, and the Action Party, which only really existed during the resistance it was founded as a party in 43 at the beginning of 1943 at the beginning of the resistance, and then in 1947 it dissolves, having done very poorly in the first post-war elections. The Action Party draws on several different sort of streams of thinkers. So one among those, for instance, would be Piero Gobetti, who was he was a young intellectual who was killed by the fascists in 1926, aged only, I believe, only 23, but who had collaborated with Antonio Gramsci's Ordine Nuovo in Turin in the aftermath of World War One, where in 1919 to 20, you have widespread factory occupations. And so the Gobetti kind of stream of liberal socialism is kind of like quite close to something that you might call libertarian socialism in the sort of Anglophone countries, in the sense of like it's a socialism of self-managed enterprises, of, you know, workers taking over the factories and the peasant and the land to the peasants kind of thing. So it's like a kind of not a Marxist socialism, but it shares some kind of Gramscian themes in terms of like you build a real democracy by putting the subaltern sort of in charge of their own organizations, their own sort of spaces they inhabit in society. So it's a kind of like a grassroots democracy through which you'll build a new leaders at all levels of society. But then other figures, for example, there's a group in and liberal socialism has developed over the 20s and 30s, mainly among exiles in Paris. So if we take, for example, Aldo Capitini, he's much more of a sort of a leftish liberal of a sort of Bertrand Russell type. So I mean, Bobbio himself, and also of course there's the Rosselli brothers, who were founders of the Justice and Liberty movement in the late 20s, and they were also killed by the fascists in French exile. And these Bobbio himself sort of theorizes the distinction between liberal socialists, who are basically socialists who uphold sort of liberal political rights in a way which Marxist socialists don't, and then there's in Italian the adjective and the noun go the other way around anyway. Liberal socialism as socialism with the defense of liberal rights, and then there's kind of social liberalism, you might translate it, which is more like liberalism, but which also takes into account the like the reality of the growth of the workers' movement and the social question. So Bobbio calls the one the right wing of socialism and the other the left wing of liberalism. And the Action Party, which is the second biggest party in the resistance, is the kind of fusion of these forces. And it basically, I mean, the problem of the Action Party is that it has extremely strong support and among intellectuals disaffected with the fascist regime and with the anti-fascist milieu in exile. there's a quite strong competition between it and the communists for leadership among those kind of layers I mentioned. Like say during the time of the Hitler-Stalin Pact, the sort of liberal socialist current is much more able to draw those kind of figures to its side. But the basic problem of the Action Party is that it didn't have it's like in clandestine conditions, or organizing among intellectuals, among exiles, and so on. It had a relatively strong appeal, but it's just not able to do mass politics. So, like in the factory strikes and so on during the resistance, or land occupations and so on, it doesn't have the kind of common touch that the communists have at all. And Bobbio kind of later sort of lampoons the party as saying, like, well, we're just a bunch of moralists and planners. It wasn't a real mass political party. But nonetheless, the fact that this force existed and that it has important martyrs, as I mentioned, Gobetti, the Rosselli brothers, and so on, makes it this. It's always a kind of there's a very strong myth built up around this force, because it's like, if only Italy could have had a real reformist socialist party rather than what it did have, which was a dominant conservative Christian Democrat party, and then the opposition being a party of basically Stalinist origins. So Bobbio was from this party. After the end of the resistance, he kind of withdrew for a while, at least, from frontline political activism. But I think kind of quite typical of the course of the Action Party, kind of continuing on from the tradition of the Action Party, is the fact that Bobbio and people like him, they don't become like strongly anti-communist. They basically, in the post-war situation, although there is very intense anti-communism in society, and obviously from the church and so on, and actually something I should have said, which is part of the roots of liberal socialism, is a kind of strong secularist sort of bent. So there's people like Gaetano Salvemini, who's like one of the leaders of the socialist party in the south of Italy, but it's like very much attached to these circles. And so he has this kind of idea of like socialism and liberalism kind of fuse in this kind of cleaning up of the state, a modern democracy where rights are guaranteed and the church is kind of, you know, stops being at this like overbearing presence. So the thing with Bobbio is, after the war, is that even though he's very critical of like Stalinism and, you know, the Communist Party of the immediate post-war years certainly was very Stalinist, he nonetheless sees the PCI as the privileged interlocutor. So he has this famous line, which is like, neither with the communists nor without them. You know, like he can't be like in the party, because that would just be shutting himself up. But nonetheless, they are that party and the workers it represents are the subject of social change to which he relates.
Maybe moving a little bit more into the kind of structure or position of the PCI itself. One of the questions I sent you that is to some degree a little bit more tangential, but I think is an interesting one for a lot of people. And this is partially just out of personal interest too, because I've been reading the relatively new translation of the Mario Tronti. My pronunciation is probably awful there, but the Workers and Capital book that has come out in English is kind of, you've mentioned, you know, the importance of Gramsci, who kind of, you know, one of the quintessential, quote, Western Marxists. And, you know, I think a lot of people read him primarily in a kind of philosophical sense, or he's one of those people you read to get you know, these like great quotes from the talk about, you know, the now is the time of monsters and et cetera, et cetera. But it's, I think, easy to overlook that he actually did have a very, a pretty significant impact on how the, at least from my understanding, how the PCI conceived of its kind of strategy and like his theories of hegemony and stuff, from my understanding, did have an impact on people like, what's his name? Is it Togliatti? Yeah. But at the same time, also, there was, from what I've read, you know, some amount of debate about how Gramsci related to the party. You know, there's the kind of cult figure, you know, Bordiga, there's the Bordigist tendency, and the Tronti and the autonomous tendency kind of try to play around and do different things with and conceive of it differently as well. Could you speak a little bit about maybe that influence and some of those debates that start showing up as the Italian communist movement gets a little bit more diverse, I guess, might be the best way to put it, or how it's kind of conceiving of its strategy and the internal kind of shifts in position that are going on there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, one of the really decisive things in understanding Gramsci's influence over the post-war PCI, and in fact the way that he's interpreted even like far beyond sort of politics, you know, in things like cultural studies and so on, is that there's a kind of apparent disconnect between his own real political activity and then what he is kind of supposed to have meant in his writings, because, you know, by far the you know, the work that people most drawn and most interested in are his prison notebooks, which were written, you know, after he had irretrievably been forced out of frontline political activity. So, you know, because they were written between, you know, 1928 and 1935 when he was in a fascist jail. Part of the way they're written is like that they're sort of a bit elusive, in the sense that, you know, he because the prison censors and so on. So, like, you know, he the use of the phrase philosophy of praxis rather than Marxism or and so on. But also, of course, the important thing is that his prison notebooks were not, you know, published at the time they were written, obviously. So, you know, in the period that the Communist Party really becomes a mass political force, which is basically through and because of the resistance, the actual understanding of his ideas among the militants of the party is extremely low, because they just aren't, you know, it's like the prison notebooks, like, literally are like totally unavailable. Mm-hmm. Even apart from all of the problems of, like, you know, how would you organize, you know, militant education and so on in clandestine conditions. And the prison notebooks are in the personal possession of Palmiro Togliatti. They've been like spirited away to Moscow. They're in his personal possession. And he has the problem of like how he can release this material in a way that will basically be consonant with the party line that, in any case, isn't really decided by Togliatti or by the Italian communist leaders, but is functional to, or at least at most we could say, like, any margin for maneuver exists entirely within what Stalin and the Soviet leadership are willing for them to do. Mm-hmm. So in 1944, Togliatti's been away from Italy for more than 15 years. And he comes back from Moscow to Rome, and he carries out what's called the Salerno Turn, which is basically that in the Allied occupied areas, the monarchy still exists. and there's a government led by former fascist general Pietro Badoglio. And the anti-fascist parties had long been unwilling to collaborate with this government, even in fighting together against the Nazis. Basically, the anti-fascist parties demand that the Western allies should recognize them as the real government instead. And Togliatti comes back and says, like, no, this is silly. Let's just join in with Badoglio, and then they'll have a referendum on the monarchy after the war. And that's exactly what happened. So the sort of the reason why left-wing critics of Togliatti would oppose this is that basically the anti-fascist parties, even beyond the question of the king himself, they basically agreed that the new post-war state would be rebuilt on the basis of like what survived of the old state bureaucracy. You know, so rather than the resistance like directly creating new organs of power itself, they would just like take over the state that had been basically stolen back from the fascists. At the time that Togliatti makes this move, he also needs to assert his own authority within the party, within the Communist Party, because it's a clandestine party. But it's been recreated at a local level by loads of sort of isolated militants, often without good central coordination. So there's a sort of battle for the exiled leaders returning to Italy to actually impose their authority over the party. And basically, Gramsci is Togliatti's instrument for imposing his own leadership, in sort of asserting the kind of like the sort of doctrinal orthodoxy of what he's doing. Firstly, in this, and Gramsci is useful in two ways. Firstly, because he's an anti-fascist martyr. So you know, much unlike Amadeo Bordiga, who you mentioned, you know, Gramsci had like basically died in a fascist jail. And secondly, in the sense that Gramsci nonetheless provides a link back to the sort of revolutionary origin of the Communist Party and, you know, the period of 1917 and all that. And Gramsci is much better known among militants than Togliatti himself. So basically, even at the time of Salerno turn, as I say, the moment where the party forms a government together with the other anti-fascist parties, but also, as I said, together with the monarchy, that's when he starts building up the cult of Antonio Gramsci. So Gramsci becomes like a patriot, a great Italian. Gramsci is in continuity with the history of the fight for Italian national independence and so on. And then kind of later in the 40s, when he starts releasing the prison notebooks as like published books, they're like heavily like censored and reordered in order to be both entirely uncritical of the Soviet Union and to be like to give a more like patriotic aura. So this kind of problematizes a bit the question of hegemony, in the sense that doing all of those things from Togliatti's point of view could be seen as like a way of helping the communists establish their hegemony, because in the national liberation struggle, because they adopt, you know, a patriotic image in continuity with Italian history, they present what they're doing as common sense, they kind of abandon the kind of insurrectionary idea of revolution. But at the same time, he's also like molding Gramsci to suit the particular political circumstances of the moment in what is certainly in a kind of scholarly or like philological sense, a quite crude version of Gramsci. Like, you know, like he invents, like, yes, he even has stuff which is like he kind of makes, like he literally like ventriloquizes Gramsci to say like, oh, Trotsky was a son of a whore. Which like Gramsci like totally didn't say, but it became like a famous saying. And at the same time, though, it's also true that like had it not been for a certain way of presenting Gramsci, then it would have just been impossible within the limits of the Stalin era communist movement to like use Gramsci's work at all. So what Togliatti is doing is kind of like making a Gramsci that will suit the limits imposed on him, but which also kind of in a way does point to something other than the most like, you know, it's also, you know, even a kind of debased Gramsci is still something different from just like crude workerism and the kind of Stalinist politics, for instance, presented by the French Communist Party of the same time, which, you know, although both the Italian and French Communist Parties certainly have nothing like, you know, internal, you know, they have like public internal disagreement or anything like that. But the Italian Communist Party is nonetheless somewhat more open to pluralism, kind of trying to include different currents or different, let's say, different sensibilities within the leadership. And Togliatti's kind of skill is kind of, and actually in a way it is something drawn from Gramsci's own leadership of the party in the mid-20s. It's to kind of keep the opposition sort of on side by giving them minor roles rather than just expelling them entirely. So in that sense, it is somewhat more liberal than say the French or even the British Communist parties. So do you want me to say something else about like other, you know, Tronti and so on?
Sure. I know I would be interested if you don't mind talking about it. And maybe, you know, once we kind of develop more on that context, we can maybe talk about like the historic compromise or something after that.
Yeah, for sure. Okay. So, as I said, earlier on, the Communist Party emerges from the war massively strengthened. In its initial phase of existence in the early 1920s, it had never had more than 60,000 members, whereas by the end of the 1940s, it had more than 2 million members. And, you know, it had, even apart from raw numbers, it had a kind of influence over, like, you know, the arts and culture, and, you know, built up its kind of own institutions of, you know, like teaching people how to read and workers' clubs and sort of social activities and all sorts. But nonetheless, it has this problem, which is like, you know, it has committed to a democratic road to socialism, what Togliatti calls the Italian road to socialism. Also in the kind of, you know, national aspect of that is the idea of a, basically an alliance which includes other non-working class forces. So, you know, obviously Italy, or then, it's still true now, has, you know, there are like some islands of blue-collar worker organization. But there's also just a massive peasantry, masses of small businesses or like sort of individual artisans and so on. And Togliatti also wants to bring them into the fold and does so partly in a, under a sort of patriotic banner. And one which kind of refuses some of the more kind of like militant and insurrectionary impulses among the base of the party or some of the militants who preserve a very kind of like, you know, like there's this, you know, like I studied, you know, in my own PhD, I studied the resistance in Rome. And one of the two like really common expressions the militants sort of are heard to say, like, you know, in like Cader's writing reports on like the militants who are like getting out of line. Yeah. One of the things that they always say is we need to do like in Russia, by which they mean like, let's do like 1917. We just need to like seize power by force. And then another one is Adeveni Befone, which means like big mustache has to come. So it's like, what we need is like a Soviet invasion and then we'll win. And so, like, the party leadership never at all indulges these sentiments, but they're simply, like, there, and they're, like, a way of it's a way of the militants to rationalize to themselves, like, well, the party actually, its practice is kind of quite reformist, but eventually will seize power. And the problem is that over the 50s and 1960s, the party makes some electoral progress, but it's like nowhere near being able to like form a government, and it's like even its potential allies are pretty weak. I mean, the Socialist Party, Italy has a quite odd Socialist Party because it was smaller than the Communist Party, not very anti-communist, and much lower social weight. And basically there was no chance that the communists and socialists together could form a government. But in the, the 50s are like a very dark period for the communists because, they face a lot of repression. There's several instances where, where the police like crush strikes and so on, killing workers. In 1960, there was even an attempt to form a Christian Democrat government that would rely in parliament on neo-fascists. So the whole situation is really bad. But then in the very early 1960s, partly as a result of the resistance to this government I mentioned, which tried to base itself on neo-fascist support, there was like very powerful waves of revolt against that government, and then strike waves in like 1962, 1963, which kind of bring that kind of elemental social struggle back into the Italian political arena in a way that hadn't existed since the end of the war. And basically that provides the kind of historical backdrop to which, for figures like Mario Tronti, then in the Socialist Party, Raniero Pensieri, and then people like Tony Negri and Romano Arquati and so on, who are mainly like young intellectuals who basically it's patent that the Communist Party strategy isn't really working, but they see these new signs of labor militancy and are... think that this is the new revolutionary subject. The Communist Party doesn't respond that positively to this kind of industrial militancy because it tends to see, it kind of tended to see sort of sporadic outbursts of revolt as likely to fail. This is something, even Gramsci talks about, like Italy has a long history of stuff like kind of like social revolts, which are kind of like desperate, but have no chance. But, they're like desperate, like even like armed uprisings in like small southern centers, which are just bound to be crushed. Eric Hobsbawm writes about it as well in Primitive Rebels, even kind of banditry and so on. And in the 50s and 60s, when you have millions of southern workers pulled into the northern factories, the big industrial centers of Italy are Milan, Turin, and Genoa in the 50s and 60s enjoy an enormous increase in the total numbers of workers. Italy is enjoying very strong economic expansion in this period. It's called the economic miracle. The statistic I do know, which is like between 1955 and 1971, 9 million Italians migrate between regions of Italy. And basically it's southerners who live in areas where there's like very little industry moving up north to work in big factories. And these kind of workers are kind of less because they're from the south, they don't really have the experience of the resistance in the way that northern areas do, and they're generally like less likely to be involved in the PCI. So when these workers, who are at first perceived as a very conservative force, kind of like low-skilled, routine manual workers, when they start kicking off, the workers who are more likely to be aligned to the PCI who are more like skilled workers who have a more kind of like craft approach to their work, you know, sort of pride in labor and so on. There's a enormous culture clash between those two. I mean, you could even say generations of workers. And the fact that this latter group exists, this upsurge of industrial militancy, gives rise to far left groups outside of the PCI. People like Mario Tronti are actually not, Tronti's never really involved in the sort of politically organized extra-parliamentary left. He's first involved in as I mentioned, Reniero Pensieri. So basically some figures around the left wing of the Socialist Party. This is also like the time after like 1956, you know, like Khrushchev's denunciation of Stalin and the Hungarian revolt being suppressed and so on. So you have this kind of like new kind of like, well, you know, it's like the new left. So those kind of things fuse and you get this. Pensieri has a journal called Quaderni Rossi, like Red Notebooks, which Tronti and also Tony Negri write for. Then they split away and form their own journal in 64 called Classe Operaia, like working class. And basically they begin to question not only the PCI's attitude towards these specific strikes, but rather like the whole like kind of Gramscian conception of the party and philosophical tradition. Tronti and Negri soon, diverge, but particularly through the Negri wing, you have the development of Autonomia, which starts off from Operaismo in the 60s Autonomia after about 1973. Basically, Operaismo is kind of like at its most like crude, to say this in a very crudely reductive way, Operaismo, literally workerism, is whereas the Communist Party wants to build a broad democratic alliance through institutions. In fact, the workers in the factories are the leading agent and of change through their revolt, and they don't want to take over capitalism or to administer capitalism. What they want is to reject work itself. They want to like they don't want to run their workplaces. They don't want to work. And that's the kind of genesis of phrases like strategy of refusal. The basic idea being that because capitalism will be forced to react to the workers like absenteeism and slowdowns or strikes and so on, that eventually the workplaces will become automated and so on. Like as a response to workers' indiscipline, and that this will like lay the bases for a post-capitalist society, particularly after the decline of in 69 in particular, the year of the hot autumn, you have extremely powerful, indeed kind of continuous strike wave. I think it's something like 480 million working days are lost, I think maybe that year and the year after. This also gives rise to kind of like Leninist political groups outside the PCI, which are kind of like to varying degrees kind of on a spectrum between Trotskyism and Maoism, but also sort of somewhat imbued with the kind of ideas I just mentioned about the primacy of workplace struggle specifically. I mean, I can talk about this in depth, what then happens is kind of when the factory struggle dies away, then you have a bunch of like very militant and, you know, like Leninist groups, you know, like say Potere Operaio, which is Negri's one, Otto Comunista, which is Adriano Sofri's, And, you know, they have like many thousands of members. They believe the revolution is imminent and that the Communist Party is the thing holding it back. Then the workers, the sort of shop floor movements, which they always relate to in a kind of from the outside, they start dying away. And then they think like, well, you know, where's the revolution going to come from now? And some of the more sane ones basically sort of lower their horizons a bit. Whereas some of the others sort of turn rather more towards the sort of armed struggle kind of conception of politics.
Yeah, the kind of terroristy. You mean like with the? Because I know like Negri gets like arrested and stuff.
Yeah, so I mean, so the thing is that the Red Brigades who you know, adopts like terrorism as a explicit strategy. They're basically the idea being, you know, like a bit like during the resistance, like, well, the masses are sort of passive, but if you cause spectacular clashes, then that will sort of spark them into action. The Red Brigades come much more from a, well, they have some like ex-PCI people from the resistance, the kind of, but the kind of people who'd like, you know, never gave away their guns kind of thing. And then a more strictly kind of Maoist and third worldist influence. Mm-hmm. Whereas there are other groups who are much, who are not like terroristic, and including like, autonomia circles around Negri, but which are nonetheless kind of somehow adjacent to them.
Yeah.
Or would like kind of affect them. Refuse to condemn them and that kind of stuff. But then even then, I mean, but there's also a kind of more kind of in the autonomous milieu, there's a kind of low level thuggery, you know, like Tony Negri having his rivals in the academy kneecapped.
Kneecapped, yeah. Which sounds so insane to think of, because he was like a professor and stuff too, like...
Yeah, it's really funny because actually, in a way, I mean, he was, it must be admitted, unfairly prosecuted for his supposed connections. You know, like the way it was presented in the courtroom was as if like he had like planned the Red Brigades and they actually did not. But I mean, I think he is in many ways also just like a really old school, like posh anti-communist who gets a job as a tenured professor and then bullies all his rivals.
Yeah.
So I you know, I think of him as a really distasteful figure, but yeah, I mean, so, and you know, there is like, by the end of the '70s in particular, there's like very intense state repression, which extends far beyond the actual organizers of terrorism or violence or whatever, you know, thousands of people arrested. Also there's stuff like, thousands of people jailed is what I mean by that. And then also there's like, you know, say the area of Rome where I used to live, San Lorenzo, which is like a historically left-wing district and kind of is still now. You know, just like the massive, promotion of heroin use by the Italian state in order to destroy the left. Like, you know, that sounds like a kind of mad conspiracy theory, but it's what happened, you know. Like because it's like after the like Italian, effectively the kind of Italian 68 as it were, you know, this massive rise of the far left and also of like you know, like students and so on, young workers being pulled into the revolutionary left, and then it's kind of defeated, and then there's this wave of repression. You know, a few thousand people head into the so-called underground, which is like armed struggle, which, you know, is a real dead end politically. And then, but then, you know, there's a much wider array of people who are, you know, very defeated and depressed, perhaps cut off from their other kind of support networks and so on, and that's a, you know, really grim outcome. So, you know, although It's kind of difficult to sort of condemn too strongly the politics, because obviously a lot of people sort of engaged in good faith or sort of with good intentions and were then, crushed. Mm-hmm. But that's a very grim experience. And I think there's a certain tendency, particularly in English-speaking reflection on Italy in the 60s and 70s, to really kind of glorify the idea that it was a kind of like constantly effervescent revolutionary movement. Whereas like the Communist Party, which has like far greater social numbers and weight and so on, is just presented as if it was this like conservative force that didn't want the revolution to happen, which I think is a bit silly.
That might be a good time to kind of move on. I could talk also about, listen to stuff about that period forever too. It is super fascinating. But maybe that's a good time to talk a little bit more about what the PCI's position was kind of moving into the 70s and beyond, and talking a bit to bring Bobbio back in about the what was called the historic compromise in the 1970s between the PCI and the Christian Democratic Party, which I know that Bobbio was a big advocate for. It's obviously of importance because it's called the historic compromise, but I could only kind of like find some stuff on it on the Wikipedia page, and it's not exactly clear. I don't have any books or anything that really had a good summary of like what was really going on with that compromise between those two parties that, as you were saying, were kind of seen as like the, you know, Christian Democrats dominating on one side and the PCI kind of being the opposition on the other, and what was really going on. So could you speak a little bit about what was happening during that time and what kind of ended up being the consequence for the PCI and kind of the Italian politics on the left at that time? Did that kind of play into the more kind of Euro-communist turn that would later kind of develop?
Yeah, so from 1948 until 1976, the Communist Party increased its vote at every single general election, like very gradually growing, whereas the Christian Democrats tended to kind of slightly lose support, also because of like the declining social weight of the church, and there are various small kind of liberal or softly centre left parties to whom it's losing out. In the early 60s, after the failure of its attempt to build a government reliant on neo-fascist parliamentary support, it started looking around for other allies. And in 1963, it formed a government dependent on the socialists. And this is called the centre-left, because it's like the centre and left governments. And the first of these was led by Aldo Moro, who's like a sort of centrist figure in the Christian Democrats, including also the socialists. So from 63 till 68, there were a series of governments, many of which included the socialists. And basically in the 70s, the Communist Party kind of hoped to be able to do the same as the socialists had and be sort of properly integrated into national government as a fully sort of legitimate party government. From 1970, also there'd been regional governments had been created. So most famously in Emilia-Romagna, you might have seen there's a book called Red Bologna by Max Jegi, like J-A with a number out, G-G-I, where he talks about the Communist Party administration of Bologna, which is the capital of Emilia-Romagna. And they had stuff like free public transport and various sort of quite advanced reforms. Also in from 1972, the new Communist Party leader, Enrico Berlinguer, and he becomes the leading exponent of what became called Eurocommunism. He took over the party in 72, and after the 76 election, where the Communists came only 3 points behind the Christian Democrats, got 34% of the vote. There was no majority in Parliament. He proposed that the Communists would allow the Christian Democrats to rule. The Communists would just like not vote in any vote of confidence, and that would allow a government to be formed that was in effect dependent on their support. They still didn't have any ministers, and they never would. But the idea was that the government would somehow be kind of conditioned by their presence, and this would be a sort of prelude to them eventually becoming more actively involved. Certainly, as part of the, a part of the reason for this, and very strongly presented as like the reason why it was necessary, certainly in terms of like presenting it to more skeptical militants, was that, this is only a few years after the overthrow of Salvador Allende's government in Chile. And of course, Chile had much stronger democratic traditions than Italy. Chile had been a parliamentary democracy since the start of the 1910s. And so basically what Allende like won the popular vote in the presidential election in 1970, but he won it by getting I don't know the exact figure, but it's something like he got 37% and the Christian Democrat got 34%. And then, he then ruled on that basis, but it was extremely unstable. And then he was ultimately overthrown. So basically what Berlinguer, the leader of the PCI, says is similarly, the PCI might edge out the Christian Democrats, but if we're going to make a real program of social change, we can't just have a third of the population behind us. We need like 60 or 70%. So the idea basically of the historic compromise, it's one of the communists' many attempts, dating back even to the time of the Anti-Fascist Alliance during the war, where they try and insist that they are like a necessary and indeed structural part of Italian democracy, and no government should be formed without them. So this is basically sunk by, well, certainly like the thing that triggers its failure is the Red Brigade's capture or kidnapping of Aldo Moro, who, as I said earlier, was the very figure who had brought the socialists into government in the 60s with the Christian Democrats, and now was the main Christian Democrat leader willing to bring the communists into government and maybe even ministerial posts. So the morning of the confidence vote, which was the second confidence vote in the government and would have been the first time that the communists had actively supported it, the Red Brigade kidnapped Moro. Basically, then the Christian Democrats refused to negotiate for his retrieval, and then he was murdered, and that in May 78, and that provided the pretext for the Christian Democrats to abandon any sort of cooperation with the communists. Of course, it's not purely a question of parliamentary tactics. Like, all of this brought into question some big issues of political principle, and one of which was, would the communists be able or else willing to enter the government of a NATO country, which had not happened up to that point? It actually later would do in France, in the Mitterrand government. But Berlinguer actually was interviewed and said that he felt safer under the NATO nuclear umbrella. And this helps give rise to what you yourself mentioned, Eurocommunism, which is like the idea of a Italian communism, not only being kind of autonomous from Moscow, but actually quite hostile to it. Eventually in 1981, Berlinguer would say that the propulsive force of the October Revolution is over. Democracy is a universal value. There's also something I actually touched on in my book, which you mentioned earlier, is the kind of economics of this, because this is after the oil shock of 73, 74, and the Christian Democrats are imposing austerity measures. And the Communist Party actually kind of rationalizes its own reason for accepting like austerian ideas. Partly this is a kind of we need to cut down on the bureaucratic inefficiencies and corruption of the state. Partly it's like there are moral values other than consumerism, and we need a kind of austerity of habit. And then there's also the kind of impending European monetary union and the kind of conditions that imposes. And so the Communist Party starts listening to economists like Franco Modigliani, like kind of MIT, sort of ex-Keynesian neoliberals, and basically works itself into a position where it's willing to vote through public spending cuts in the name of really just neoliberal economic ideas, but which are at this point, literally like 1976, 77, are very like incipient. And this also helps explain how come the Communist Party eventually became an entirely liberal and centrist party. Today, what was the Communist Party, the bulk of it is in the party called the Democrats, which are like to the right of all other European social democratic parties. They're just pro-European liberals and nothing else. Bobbio relates to all this because even in like the late 40s, early 50s, he had this idea of the Communist Party as like a central interlocutor. Part of his writing is kind of like in 54. So it's like after Stalin dies, but before Khrushchev repudiates Stalin. He has a series of articles which are collecting a book called Politica e Cultura, where he criticizes the Communist Party for not embracing the legacy of like European, like sort of critical thinking, and the sort of democratic elements of the Enlightenment tradition, including like focus on individual rights, and saying that you can't just kind of throw that stuff overboard just because it's hypocritical. Bobbio does recognize that liberal rights are kind of made a mockery of by the reality of authoritarian power outside the directly political field, in like the church or businesses and so on. Like his positions on that are more or less just like Marxist ones. But on, he has this focus on, democratic rights and, or not just democratic rights, but rather like individual rights and liberal protection, sort of checks and balances and so on, separation of powers, that kind of thing. And Togliatti and Galvano della Volpe, the PCI-aligned philosopher at that time anyway, respond to that pretty harshly, basically calling him a liberal idealist and saying that the Soviet Union's the greatest democracy in the world. But by the 70s, Bobbio's positions have become much more like in line with what the PCI is doing and could be said to be influencing it. So he has a series of, I think it's just two articles in 75 and 76, where he basically says Marxism doesn't have a theory of the state. It doesn't have a developed sense of political science. and it's basically willing to throw representative democracy overboard in the name of dictatorship of the proletariat, and it needs to break off its last sort of Leninist traces. So, you know, he can see the kind of positive movement towards, you know, pluralism, embrace of the, basically the kind of reformist social democracy, which he essentially is aligned with. But you know, this time in the 70s, I say, you know, things are heading in his direction, because the, as I said, Berlinguer does say that, or does eventually in 81 at least, he says, yes, democracy is a universal principle. But there is also some pushback against Bobbio also in this phase, even by people who aren't opposed to the historic compromise, not opposed to the, on principle, to the idea that the communists could make a pact with the Christian Democrats. Also because Bobbio has a certain kind of, he has a very strong focus on the primacy of representative democracy and kind of like the formalities of parliamentary process and separation of powers and so on. Whereas, so while the like sort of very central leaders of the PCI don't push back against him strongly, and indeed they invite him to write for the party newspaper, L'Unità, some kind of the more left-wing leaders push back, particularly Pietro Ingrao. Pietro Ingrao had been the leader of the, he wasn't like the main leader, but he was on the central committee and Politburo. So he was the one who in like 68 and the early 70s had been most sort of receptive to the kind of student movements and saying that the PCI needed to like listen more, also to some workers' wage demands, the one who was most skeptical about the sort of incipient neoliberal economics and so on. So he has a book from 77 called Masses and Power, in which he sort of asserts that the guarantee of workers, the guarantee of democratic rights has always been the existence of a strong workers' movement, even if it was like not integrated into sort of representative or parliamentary process. Like basically like the existence of the social movement or the workers' movement as a counterweight, sort of itself imposed a certain kind of accountability, you know, in the sense like the thing that keeps democracy democratic isn't like the electoral commission that supervises elections. It's that you have like a mobilized population who are like ready to call out abuses and injustice. Also, I mean, the other thing that could be said about that is that Bobbio was actually very hostile to the kind of like extra parliamentary left of the like late 60s and early 70s. He was much, you know, his idea of like pluralism is like the Communist Party in Parliament, you know, makes a deal with the Christian Democrats in Parliament rather than, you know, sort of you know, in fairness, Bobbio also talks about like extending representative democracy also to other like units of societies, so, like workplaces and stuff. But I think he has something of an elitist conception of political action, I think. Also, like, you know, although he was certainly pleased by the Communist Party's evolution and its like repudiation of Leninism and so on, he's closer to the Socialist Party, which is undergoing a quite strange evolution in the same period, because the Socialists were opposed to the historic compromise separate from it, but in they're also like moving away from a formal commitment to Marxism. You know, some of your readers, sort of listeners might know that, you know, like say, for example, like the German Social Democrats only formally abandoned their commitment to Marxism in 1960. But the Italian Socialists actually took another 20 years to do so. And until 1982, the Italian Socialist Party had as its logo a hammer and sickle. So Bobbio is actually involved in writing the Italian Socialist Party program in 1978, and it's like historic leader, who's then kind of, you know, soon before he died, Pietro Nenni, strongly embraces Bobbio's ideas. But then in the 80s, the party moved very sharply to the right when it itself sort of became a leading force in government under Bettino Craxi. But yeah, I mean, that's certainly that kind of late 70s, early 80s period is definitely the one in which Bobbio is himself most directly involved in sort of, as it were, kind of not exactly frontline politics, but he's certainly like a someone who's a prominent political voice in public debate. He only became a senator a bit later, I think in 84. And then, you know, from then on, he was a socialist senator and then one for the Democrats of the left in the 90s. But that's you know, he defines himself as a man of the First Republic. The First Republic is basically the parties of the resistance and the political regime they maintain until the early 1990s. And the period of the historic compromise, 76 to 79, is basically the high point of that, because it's when the parties are almost aligned to each other.
Well, we've been talking for a little bit now, and I think for listeners, this is just going to be a great, it's a, kind of a great, you know, hour and a half crash course on just Italian politics all the way down. Do you, as we wrap up, do you want to talk just a little bit maybe about your book that's coming out tomorrow, and any other writing or projects that you're on that people should check out, or any other resources that maybe you would recommend that people read or look into?
Mm-hmm. Well, so my book, First They Took Rome, is about the rise of the populist right in Italy over the last 30 years. So basically, whereas I think there's a certain kind of stereotype about Italy that it's like a mess and backwards, and it needs to catch up with other more normal countries, you know, less corrupt and more normal party system. Basically, what I argue is that the kind of changes that Italy went through in the early 1990s, with the collapse of many of the parties we've been talking about, and with the rise of kind of media-driven, personality-led political vehicles with like a very weak internal democracy, with lack of roots in society, basically like this process foreshadows what's happening across almost the entire West now. So, you know, I think like it's now a fairly well-worn comparison, but, you know, like you can already see Trump in Berlusconi. But that also, you know, as part of that, the there's a kind of myth that the reason why the far right is strong is because disaffected left-wing workers are moving their support to far-right parties. And I basically show that this isn't true. The workers are no longer voting at all, and a very small proportion of them are turning to the far right. But the real dynamic process is a radicalization of the right, driven by the self-dissolution of the left. I mean, as I said earlier, the Italian communists turned into a liberal centrist party, an anti-communist party, on every issue of historical memory, talking about the resistance, talking about fascism. They capitulated, and they basically replaced a politics of standing up for workers' interests with a politics of balanced budgets and meeting European demands and so on. So the left has basically destroyed its own social base, whereas the right has radicalized. The other thing I'm working on is a biography of Amedeo Bordiga, who's the founder of the Italian Communist Party, and that will come out sometime next year. On the history we're talking about, though, I think the best thing to read, there's recently reissued from Verso Books, is The Tailor of Ulm by Lucia Magri. It's M-A-G-R-I. And that's a sort of a critical perspective on the Communist Party, but from someone, you know, it's far from a kind of demolition or attack on its tradition. It's from Magri was a figure in Il Manifesto, which was like a group informed by the kind of Gramsci-Togliatti tradition, but which was pushed out of the party after 68. And The Tailor of Ulm is a very intelligent and evocative reflection on the party after its demise. So I'd particularly recommend that. I think it's probably the most interesting single thing you could read.
Thank you so much again for coming on talking about this. I think this is just a really in-depth, as in-depth as you can be in a couple hours discussion, and you've just really gone deep into like a lot of these things that I don't think are quite as accessible to English speakers and readers.
Yeah, well, thanks a lot for having me on. It's always a pleasure to talk about.
Thank you for joining us on this bonus episode of the Radical Thoughts podcast. If you want to check out Broder's book, you can find it in the show notes. Just a quick reminder that our next episode will be on Chantal Mouffe's The Return of the Political, so check that out if you want to read along with us. We also dropped another bonus episode, that makes two this month. This other bonus episode is available for free on the public feed, and it features an interview with me and one of my personal friends talking a bit more about contemporary events with Black Lives Matter and issues of identity and a whole bunch of other stuff. So I highly recommend that you check it out. It's a really good conversation. Radical Thoughts is an independent project. It's not associated with Verso Books. Thanks for listening, and we hope you'll join us next time.